Okay, our first speaker of the morning is actually sponsored by Weber County ENT Physicians. So when I name these physicians off, if you could please stand. Alexander Ramirez, Doug Anderson, Nadim Akazi, Stuart Barlow, and Michael Schuler. One thing that's important to know is we're able to keep our dues at a pretty low level because of people who sponsor these talks. So if we could give a round of applause for the sponsors, that would be great. Our first speaker is James Grua from Ogden, Utah. He'll be speaking on thyroid. Dr. Grua studied steroid biochemistry at the University of Utah, where he also went to medical school. He did internal medicine residency at the University of Wisconsin, came back and did a fellowship in endocrinology at the University of Utah, and then he's been working for Intermountain Healthcare as an endocrinologist for 16 years. He does adult and pediatric endocrine at Salt Lake and LDS Hospital. He teaches as a clinical instructor of medicine for the physician assistant program at the University of Utah, and he is the only endocrinologist in the region with a radioiodine license for treating hyperthyroidism and thyroid cancer. And of note, Dr. Grua's father was Ernest Grua, who many of you will remember, who was a prominent surgeon in Ogden and actually was the president of this organization in 1962 and then served as its secretary from 1956 to 1961. So if you could all welcome Dr. James Grua.
Does this work? You can hear me? It is a pleasure to be here. It harkens back memories when I was a child and all I heard about was Ogden Surgical Society and George Pfister lived next door and all the names that are in your booklet for the historic history of the society are things I grew up with, so it's nice to be here. I'm in Salt Lake and they asked me to talk about what's new in thyroid. And that's hard to say. I have two goals. One is to sort of briefly go over thyroid testing, since when you and I see patients every day, we always do blood tests, and they're always telling us they're tired and they can't lose weight. It must be their thyroid. At least that's what I hear all day long. I don't know if you do. And the second part is I want to talk briefly about the alternative therapies that are becoming increasingly popular, the Armour thyroid, Natrethroid, that you're seeing increasingly used, and I think you'll see more of them in the future. So he says, that changed. This is an article a patient gave me just about 4 weeks ago. This is in the Wall Street Journal from middle of April. And it talks about thyroid patients are rising up and demanding better care. It's actually a pretty good article. You can just Google Wall Street Journal and thyroid if you want to read it. But the argument there is that many patients are insisting on alternative therapies. What I find every day is patients come in and they already have a preordained agenda of what they expect to get, and they're going to tell me what to prescribe because they've read online, they've diagnosed themselves, and they've picked out their medicines. They know what they want. So it's a negotiation. I tend to be more flexible than some people are. I think there's lots of right ways to treat thyroid. So first, I want to just go over some guidelines. There are published guidelines out there. ACE is the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists. ATA is the American Thyroid Association. They publish guidelines every several years. And they stress their guidelines are not rigid rules. There's a lot of leeway. They don't say you have to do exactly their way. The guidelines have these, I don't think, very good guidelines of saying hypothyroidism, overt hypothyroidism with TSH over 10. I have patients who come in with a TSH of 10 who say they feel great. I don't have to treat those patients. The majority of my patients with a TSH of 10 are tired, and the majority of patients I see with a TSH of 2 are tired. So we're going to get to the next couple slides. We're going to talk about what the definitions of normal. Do we care? On any test that I do, the whole point of testing to me is to find out, is there a reasonable expectation that the patient's going to feel better? Why do I check a testosterone level? Do I care whether their testosterone's 299 or 301 when normal's 300? No, I just want to have a glean in my mind of whether giving them testosterone is going to help. Same with thyroid. I do thyroid testing because I want to have some sense of, is this going to help? I put a couple things here real quickly. What is normal? That's one of the big things one of my little soapbox issues is what is normal? When you guys get a lab report, it's got on the right side over there, it's got a normal range. NHANES data, if you break out different subgroups, you take 13,000 patients, you exclude those who have thyroid disease, you exclude some of those who think they have thyroid disease. And you see that little graph there at the bottom. The normal reference range is actually 0.4 to 4.1 if you use that population. If you look at the IHC lab reports, they say 0.47 to 4.7 is normal. I just got a report yesterday from Revere in Payson, and their lab has a normal range of 0.27 to 3.9. I think it depends which population is used, but my point here is I think the 0.45 to 4.7 is a little, on the off side. I think it should be the normal range. If you use normal, should be a little bit lower than that. The question is, if someone comes in with a TSH of 4.7, do they feel better with thyroid or not? Are you going to label them as normal or not normal? I know a number of docs who are very rigid about this. If it's 4.6, maybe they'll just say take a nap. If it's 4.9, maybe they'll give them slight thyroid. I think it's much more nuanced than that, and I think you have to listen to the patient. That graph at the bottom sort of shows schematically that the normal range is right there. The normal the median TSH is 1.5. I just put this out there so when you see patients with their they come in with their lab slips, you can sort of get a sense of what is normal. 95% of patients without evidence of thyroid disease have a TSH of less than 2.5. My whole point here is I'm increasingly finding myself in recent years liberally giving thyroid trials to patients who have a TSH of 4.5 or 4. I don't always do that. And if I give somebody thyroid supplements with a TSH of 4, I go into it knowing that maybe they're not going to feel better. If they have a TSH of 40, they're going to feel better. If they have a TSH of 4, I say, well, maybe if I give you a TSH of 1, you'll feel better, but I don't know. A lot of people disagree with me on that. There's a lot of people who say, no, don't try to nuance the TSH within the normal range. But I have had a number of patients over the years who just do feel better if I give them a TSH of 1 or less, maybe, versus a TSH of 4. Maybe I'm not, certainly isn't true of everybody. Lots of patients I give thyroid to and they come back and say they're still tired and depressed. But I just find myself more liberal about treating patients than I used to be. So when to test, I just have one or two slides here quickly. TSH and thyroid labs do have a circadian rhythm, and the TSH is higher in the morning than it is in the evening. You will get different levels at different times of day if you're really trying to finesse things. If you look at this one study, there's a 40% variation if you take the same patient and measure them the same time of day over the period of a month. So there is a lot of variation. These numbers aren't cast in stone and handed down to a prophet. I know we don't want to get too late here. Thyroid. When I test people, I do free T4 testings. You can certainly do total T4 testings. I think they're sort of passe in my opinion, but if you do total T4 testing, you just have to know that there are some situations that will mislead you. Specifically, patients taking estrogen will have a higher total T4 because of higher carrier protein. So I advocate free T4s and not total T4s. Half-life of T4 in the blood is a week. It says here, I have down here, that T3 levels remain fairly constant, TSH levels remain fairly constant. So a free T4 is relatively steady over the course of a week. I contrast that to T3 here in a second. Most of us have spent most of your early career, my early career, not even looking at T3 very much. It's certainly coming into vogue because of all the alternative thyroid preparations out there. T3 is a more fickle lab. If you talk to the people in the RIA lab who do these, they'll say it's a little less reliable. Just because you get a number on a piece of paper doesn't mean it really means something necessarily. So there's a T3 and free T3 assays. The half-life of T3 varies widely. That's one of the problems of treating patients with T3, is the half-life varies widely in terms of what the blood levels are. Free T3 will rise after you give a dose, and that's important. You see more and more patients coming in on Armour Thyroid, Naturethroid, and what I find is if they take their Armour Thyroid at 8 o'clock in the morning and do a blood test at 10 o'clock in the morning, they'll get this transient rise in their T3 level. Had a referral just last week, TSH of 6, a little bit high, the patient's on Armour Thyroid. Free T4 was 1.0, right in the middle of normal. The free T3 came back high. So now you got a high T3, a normal T4, and a high TSH. The patient was sent to me, gee, do they have a pituitary tumor? No, I think the patient took their Armour Thyroid about an hour before they took their blood test, and the T3 just transiently measured higher. So if you measure T3 in patients, I think it's important to just educate patients to take their pills after their blood test, not before. Or just be aware that you can have these little transient rises in T3 on the blood test. Okay, just to back up, the thyroid makes mostly T4. It's a thyroid molecule with four iodine atoms. There's a hormone called deiodinase that knocks off one of the iodines and turns into T3. The cells in the body prefer T3. So majority of the you make mostly T4, but it's converted into T3, and that's what the cells prefer. The debate over the past decade or so has been, do people have a problem converting T4 to T3? Historically, that was the venue of sort of the fringe alternative naturopath, homeopath doctors. It's coming into vogue that it may actually be true. Some patients do have a deficiency of a deiodinase hormone, and they have a hard time converting T4 to T3. I think you're going to see this become more and more accepted in the next 10 years, which is the whole point of my talk, was to talk about the armor thyroid T3 things, because you have patients walking in every day asking about it. And historically, we'd say, no, we don't do armor thyroid. It's old-fashioned. No, we don't do T3. It doesn't work. Oh, it's short-lived. University still teaches that. A friend of mine is a professor at USC, and I just talked about this a couple weeks ago. They still don't do armor thyroid because it's old-fashioned. I think they're wrong. I think the pendulum is swinging back that direction. Just as long as you understand the nuances of what to expect. So when to treat, I'm not going to go into this at great length. The only thing is that the guidelines for pregnancy have tightened up for targets of TSH. So I have those at the bottom there. Pregnancy guidelines have tightened up for targets. So my target for a TSH is somewhere in the bottom end of normal without over-treating them. Again, it comes down to your definition of normal. So T4, I'm going to mention very briefly. We've all spent most of our careers treating people with thyroxine or brand name Synthroid. That's been the mainstay for decades, ever since Synthroid came on the market in the 80s. Comes in lots of doses. It's the first drug I'm going to use. I'm going to put people on thyroxine. That's my first choice. I still do. If you look down there, the clinical practice guidelines actually do recommend using a consistent brand. In an ideal world, I'd have everybody on brand name thyroid because it does make a difference, in my opinion. The generics can bounce around. You can get one batch, you'll get a generic from Sao Paulo, the next time it will be from Singapore, the next time it will be from Poland. Patient came in just this week and said, my thyroxine pill used to be this shape and now it's that shape. The color should all be the same, but the shapes change. The FDA actually allows a 20% variation either way to be bioequivalent. I have the FDA definition right there. 90% of the time, the thyroid pill has to contain between 80 and 125% of what it's supposed to have. That's a huge range. If you're giving somebody amoxicillin, maybe you don't care if it's 10% different. Thyroid, it's a whole dose. This is a graph, I don't know if you can read it or not. This is from an FDA website, just showing the 20% variation either way. The point being that in theory, 100 microgram yellow thyroid tablet might have anywhere from 80 to 120 in it. Now really, if the patient stays with the same generic brand, if their PBM gives them a brand of thyroid that's always from the same place in Brazil, they're pretty consistent. They're going to be nice and consistent. They won't bounce around. If the pharmacy benefit group puts this out for bid every year and changes providers, you can have some significant variations. Most plans don't pay for brand name. Brand name's more expensive. So the majority of my patients are probably on generics. Just know that if they're on generics, they do indeed have some levels that bounce around a little bit. Okay, let's keep going. T3 versus T3 with T4. That's the big controversy that I think most people are going to see in the next couple of years. If you're not already having patients roll in every day. I certainly have patients roll in every day. A whole generation has been taught don't do T3. I have gradually become a believer. I hate to say it. I was taught the same thing. 15 years ago, I would have said no. Nowadays, I say, sure, we'll try T3. In my practice, just anecdotally, I sense that about 50% of patients come in, and if I put them on some T3 in one form or another, they say they feel better. And about 50% come in and go, don't feel any different. All I can say is I think it's the pendulum swinging back that direction. Patients walk in and they'll say to you, I don't want that evil synthetic thyroid. I want the natural thyroid. Well, that doesn't sway me at all. The T4 is the same whether you get it from a cow or a pig thyroid or whether you make it in a test tube. So the T4, T3 are the same synthetic or natural. Some people like that natural label, and I don't waste my time arguing with them. If they come in and say, I want natural thyroid, my attitude these days is, okay, we'll try it. Armor thyroid doesn't come in as many doses, and it's a little bit harder to fine-tune. There are some nuances of the testing. That's the point of my talk here. There is some variation. There's pig thyroid, and there's bovine thyroid. They're about the same. When you're looking at these brands out there, people always come in, they always say, I want to be on armor thyroid. There's also Nature Throid and West Throid. They come in variety of sizes. I could, if anybody wants some conversion tables, they're pretty available, but what level of, what dose of armor thyroid is about equivalent to what dose of thyroxin. These are dosed in milligrams, so it's going to be 120 milligrams of armor versus 100 micrograms of thyroxin. Patients often think I'm changing their dose. If I go from 150 of thyroxin to 120 of armor, I'm going down. I'm not, because they're totally different numbers. The CPC used to say, the clinical practice guidelines used to say, use only T4. But they've downgraded that recommendation because I think the pendulum's swinging toward more and more patients who are doing just fine on T3. A friend of mine, an internal medicine doc in town I like a lot, and I share a patient, he tells the patient, no, don't do T3, it's really short acting, nobody uses it. Patient comes to me and says, but I like the T3, I feel better with the T3. So Dr. A is saying yes, Dr. B is saying no. The dose in milligrams have that down there. Some of us know the old-fashioned apothecary measurement that one grain is about 65 milligrams. One other nuance about T3, it is shorter half-life. I think that varies from patient to patient. For some patients, it does kick in and wear off over 6 to 8 hours. I tell patients, you're welcome to split your pill. Take half in the morning and half in the afternoon. Some patients swear they feel better with a little boost of T3. It keeps them awake at 7 o'clock at night instead of going to sleep after dinner. On the other hand, if I tell them to split their thyroid twice a day, you'll wake up at 11 o'clock at night and realize you didn't take your afternoon pill. I tell patients, if I give them armor or something like that, I say, experiment with it. Take all in the morning, which most of my patients do, but if you want to take half in the afternoon and see if you feel better, go to it. It does have some physiologic sense because T3 has a shorter half-life. Biotin. Well, see if there's anything else I want to say on armor for a second. I guess what I'd say about the armor Nature Throid is don't be afraid of it. I have become that some patients truly, truly feel better on it. I go into it and I tell them, you may or may not feel better on this. Is it placebo? I don't know. I went to a medical conference years ago in Boston, a couple of years ago, and a big name thyroid person was talking about thyroid, and somebody asked about armor and T3, and he said, no, we don't do T3 in my university. Patients just think they feel better. And I sat in the back room and said, patients just think they feel better. Let me think about that. Now, why are we here? You'll get a lot of resistance. Some of you are going to say, no, I don't want to do it. And that's fine. I just got to tell you, my personal experience is I've changed over the past 15 years or 20 years of doing this, and I've become a partial believer. It's not my first choice for everybody because I think thyroxin is easier to titrate with multiple doses. But if somebody wants to do it, I'm game. You can also prescribe T3 separately as Cytomel. It comes in 5s, 25s, and 50s. Nobody ever needs 50s, really. But if somebody wants to take 5, 10, 15 of Cytomel, which is T3, in addition to their T4, fine. I'm okay with it. I don't know. I tell people, if you want to try it, see. And some people come back and say, I'll feel better, and some people don't. That's two copays instead of one. One last point, because I don't want to go long here, it's early in the morning, is biotin. Biotin's had a number of articles recently. Lots of people take biotin. I don't take biotin for my hair. I gave up on that long ago. But lots of women come in saying they take biotin. Now, the FDA guidelines say you're supposed to take something like 30 micrograms a day, but patients are coming in taking 10 milligrams all the time. It turns out, largely unknown to me for most of my career, that biotin will screw up your thyroid assays sometimes. So the thyroid assays, they're either sandwich assays or they're monoclonal antibody assays that grab onto whichever thyroid molecule you're talking about, in this case TSH. And they use biotin as part of their substrate to do the assay. And if someone's taking a ton of biotin, it'll sometimes screw up the TSH assay. And I must tell you, what I read online and going through all the articles I see is that it's variable from lab to lab. Different labs have different kits. And some labs do one assay, some labs do another assay. But for most labs, if you're taking a lot of biotin, it will give you a falsely low, it'll give you a falsely high TSH sometimes. Some labs will give you falsely low TSH. So you don't really, there's no consistent lab to lab, LabCorp versus Quest versus Revere versus Ogden Regional. But just know that biotin can screw up your labs. And if you get screwy labs, again, the thyroid patient said to me a couple weeks ago with a high TSH, this was a high TSH, high T4, or upper normal T4. And the doc sent them to me saying, do they have a TSH producing tumor? I think it was their biotin. It'll go away in a day. Most of us don't think about it, but if the labs don't make sense, in the back of your mind, scratch your head and say, are you taking biotin? Maybe you can stop it for a day or two and repeat your labs. So to me, if you can get them to not do biotin, maybe that helps. If you have them do the labs in the morning, maybe that helps. Have them do their lab without taking their pill in the morning. I think that helps. And don't be afraid of the armor. As I say, I wouldn't have said this 20 years ago, but I say it now. If somebody wants to do it, I say, great, I'll do it. It's just a little harder to fine-tune the dose. If you want to make the little tiny changes, armor does not come in 20 sizes. It comes in 5 or 6 sizes. But that's the end of my talk. I want to make it short because I know it's 8 o'clock. Did I go over or under? It was quick, I think. Probably spoke too fast. Any questions? Silence. Yeah.
People are starting to take their T4 before breakfast without food and stuff. What difference is that
make? Oh, what a fabulous question. How important is it to take the thyroid on an empty stomach? Pharmacies make a big deal about that. It scares patients. Now the patient has 7 pills. They're supposed to take 6 of them all by themselves, so separate from other things, and it's just impossible to do. Yes, there are a number of things that interfere with thyroid absorption. I don't even throw on that next slide, are they? There's a slide there that has some of those things. To me, the biggest things are iron and calcium. If you take iron and calcium at the same time as your thyroid pill, the iron will bind to the T4 and you won't absorb all the T4. And you could lose 30% of it or more if you take them at the same time. On the other hand, does it make a difference if they have to grab their bran muffin and run out of the door and take their thyroid at the same time? I don't know. I take thyroid too, and I'm not very good about that. What I tell patients is, if you do the same thing consistently, I can adjust the dose around it. If you always have to take your thyroid with breakfast because you don't have time to do it in the morning, fine. Maybe I have to give you 112 instead of 100 in the long term to make it. As long as you can do it sort of consistently, we can work around it, I think. I think the pharmacy makes a little too big a deal out of it because it scares patients. Technically, they're right. It's absorbed best on an empty stomach. But I don't think it's the same degree of importance that you see with alendronate, where if you take alendronate with a bran muffin, you don't get any absorption. So I tell people it's better to take it than to not take it. I try to get them to take it before breakfast. Are they supposed to wait hours like some patients do? I think that's crazy. I try to get, if half an hour before breakfast they can, it'd be great. If they can't, don't beat themselves up over it. I find it to be a relatively minor problem in practice. Question?
My wonderful works. I like your
comments on what I believe was the 2009 Journal of Clinical Endocrinology that talked about the need, if you really wanted to follow thyroid carefully, you needed to look at the total T3 to reverse T3 ratio. And in fact, clinically, what I have found with a number of my patients, they have classic hypothyroid symptoms, the cold hands and feet, the temperature intolerance, fatigue, etc. And their reverse T3s are elevated. They go on pure Cytomel alone, and in fact, their symptoms decrease. And I've actually had 2 or 3 increases of the Cytomel, and the TSH, free T3, free T4, remain the same.
That's a great question. I didn't mention that because I can't talk about everything. So you got this thyroid molecule, it has 4 iodines on it. The body will knock one of them off with a deiodinase and make it into T3. What he mentions is another hormone called reverse T3. Now, they're both thyroid molecules with 3 iodines, but it's a different iodine that was knocked off. In theory, reverse T3 is inactive. It doesn't really do anything. It will go up in states of starvation. And what he's arguing is that some patients say if we measure T3, if reverse T3, a high reverse T3 means the patient's going to be low on T3, and maybe they would benefit from taking more T3, or in the case he mentioned, giving people Cytomel alone. I'm not opposed to that. I haven't routinely done that myself in my practice. I see more and more people doing it, and maybe that is the future, to do more of that RT3 ratio. I have argued with a friend of mine just the other day about this. You can certainly measure RT3. Just know that RT3 is not an active hormone. If it goes up, it might mean they're low on T3. He's saying that they're low on T3. They have all the classic symptoms. Their TSH might be normal, but if you give them some T3, they'll feel better. goes back to my whole point of what is testing, who's going to be treated. I'm more liberal about treating people, and just because their TSH is normal, there are times I might squeeze in some thyroid hormone. A little bit of thyroid hormone, is there a lot of risk? Not a lot of risk. If I'm going to make somebody overtly hyperthyroid, sure, I think there's risk. But a little bit, I'm not opposed. So I haven't been doing that in my practice, but I know people who do. And just be aware, starvation will make that go up. That's one of the starvation, the body responds to starvation by downregulating thyroid. It makes sense. If you're starving, you're going to lower your metabolic rate. And one of the things that lowers is T3. When someone comes in and says, I'm really rigid on my diet, I have 200 calories a day, I can't lose weight. Are they really on 200 calories a day? Well, we always say they're not. But gee, maybe they really are starving themselves, and they've downregulated their thyroid, and they could benefit from a little thyroid hormone. So I don't know, I don't have a firm opinion on that. I think it's coming in the future, though.
I was just wondering if there's any damage to take thyroid medications if your thyroid is normal in these weight loss clinics that are giving it Armour for weight loss?
You know, thyroid's not the magic answer for weight loss. I just try to tell people that. People come in and say, gee, I hear this all day long. So do you. It's not the answer for weight loss. It's not going to take you from a size 12 to a size 0. It's just not. I'm convinced at this point in my career that most of weight is actually genetically set, not thyroid set. Is there harm in giving somebody thyroid? First, I don't think, if someone has normal thyroid levels and I give them a little bit of thyroid for energy, I'm not expecting that they're going to lose a ton of weight. I tell them that. This is not the magic answer. Is there harm? I think there's harm if you give them too much thyroid and make them overtly hyperthyroid. If you drive that TSH down to 0.0 and make them hyperthyroid, I think there is a risk of osteoporosis, hair loss, insomnia. So I try not to overtreat people. If you take somebody from a TSH of 4 down, I have a relative who had a TSH of 4.7. She weighs 300 pounds and was told by her that she doesn't need thyroid. I don't know. I'm going to give her a trial on some thyroid. What's the risk of being 300 pounds versus the risk of taking some thyroid and have a TSH of 1? I know it's not what the dogma says in terms of some evidence-based medicine study, but I'm going to give her a TSH of 1 and just see if it helps, because I think anything that will help her lose that 300 pounds is any small part of it's a help, and I don't think there's a risk as long as I don't over-treat her. That's the key thing. If I over-treat her, make her hyperthyroid, that's not my goal. But will a little bit help? I don't know. It might be a minor player. So I think thyroid is a minor player in the weight loss game, and people are always hoping it's the magic cure. That's my bottom line.
One more question. Yeah. Can you speak to people using thyroid medicine for athletic performance when athletes want to...
For what?
For athletes.
Thyroid for athletes?
Yeah, so I think some figure if they can drive their TSH down that they will have better athletic performance.
I don't think so. If you take too much thyroid, I think you're going to find it actually impairs cardiovascular performance at some point. There may be a curve there somewhere. Is a TSH of 0.5 better than a TSH of 5? Maybe. But I worry that people who are doing that might just be doing random things on their own with all their steroids and all their other things too. So I don't think it's the answer for athleticism. Do people perform better with a TSH of 2 or 1 than 5? Maybe. That's why I think the normal range should change. I think the normal range should be lower than it is. And I think when we tell somebody they have a normal TSH of at 4.7, I think we're wrong. If they feel great, I don't care. I've had a patient with a TSH of 20 who comes in and says, I feel great, doc. Well, if that's fine, if their 20 gives them enough T4 to be happy on, I'm not going to treat them. But if they come in with a TSH 4 and say, I'm horrible, I'm not opposed to trying it. My expectations are just a little bit lower that it's going to be successful. So as I say, this is dogma. It's a science, and a lot of it's just my personal opinion that's changed over the years. But I think it's headed toward more of the Armour stuff, so I think you got to know about it. And if you're politically involved, there's one female candidate running for president these days who is on Armour thyroid, and I won't mention her name, but she's on Armour thyroid. I said that to a patient yesterday, and the patient said, well, I guess we have one thing in common. Anyway. And a sock.